Right, so what I'm going to do, or try to do, is to explain kind of the general, what I think are the general and important concepts of cell cycle control in eukaryotes, illustrating almost entirely with budding yeast, which is what I work on, what you see up on the screen here. So it's basically going to, the whole talk is going to be introduction almost, just a little bit of data here and there. And the format with multiple interruptions is fine. So, you know, that's all right. If I don't get to any particular place, I will at least probably have answered whatever it is that you really want to know. So this is just the experimental object that I've left up here, and there are actually some specific points. First of all, you can see from this picture why they're called budding yeast. They start off as these individual round guys, and then they make this bud, which grows, and that turns into the daughter cell. And you can't really see, but at a certain point there is cytokinesis. The cells actually physically separate and divide into, so this is not syncytial, unlike the Neurospora case. At the end of the cell cycle, when division happens, it's they fall off the edge and become two new cells that are independent.
All yeast like that. Do they all bud and divide in this funny
way? Well, all budding yeast do. There's a sizable but not an enormous family of
but fish and yeast do.
Fish and yeast are different. Fish
in the middle.
They're symmetrical.
Thank you very much.
They grow along and they chop in the middle. That's fine. Actually, this aspect of them it brings up a point. Which is that you notice that the bud, of course, starts off extremely small, and even by the time the cells have finished the division process, the daughter cell is invariably smaller than the mother's cell. So they're inherently asymmetric, just at the level of cell size. And that turns out to have consequences because, as was discovered by Lee Hartwell in the sort of late 70s or so, what you can, and actually you can, this is the type of data he was using to determine this, time-lapse photomicroscopy, and you can actually see if you just pick an individual cell and watch, there's the daughter, and now watch who buds first. It's going to be the mother, and then the daughter buds, and watch this one here, there's the mother buds, and then the daughter buds. Always, or almost always, the mother re-enters the next cell cycle before the daughter does. And what Hartwell discovered by some really elegant experiments involving practically nothing but a microscope and some toothpicks and some inhibitors of protein synthesis. I mean, nothing really compared to the technology that we have available now. But anyway, he figured out that in fact it is because the daughters are smaller, at least largely because the daughters are smaller, that they're slower to enter the next cell cycle. So if you can manipulate mother or daughter size appropriately, you can adjust the times.
The mother size and doing the budding, they roughly constant.
Pretty much the same. That's right. Basically, and that's sort of understood at a first level. The vesicles and so forth that go in to make the cell get bigger are just uniformly isotropically distributed all up until the bud forms. And part of making the bud is that all the vesicles and everything else becomes completely vectorial, and everything is shoved into the bud. Pretty much. It's very sharp, and you can pretty much see that too. I mean, if you measure these things, that's what you'll see. The mother will grow up until it buds, and then that's it. Right, then effectively all the growth goes into the bud. Another point that's really relevant is that it follows actually from this first point about the cell size that the real ultimate driving force for the cell cycle and cell cycle timing and so forth it is not the cell cycle oscillator in this case. It's just growth, right? That's the really important thing. That's what gives you the times, and of course that also gives you immediate asynchrony. Right away. You start with one cell, you have two, and you've lost synchrony right away. That causes some experimental difficulties. Excuse me?
What is the time scale?
They divide about the mass doubling time is about an hour and a half or so, corresponding to the mother is producing a new cell in about an hour and the daughter is in something longer than that. Is asymmetric, and the time scale here is I don't know exactly, but every time it flickers, every image is every 3 minutes. Gives you some rough sense. Okay. So that's that movie. Now we do have PowerPoint here. Sorry. So this is some things basically that I already said. This is the paper from 1977 by Lee Hartwell. There's one point here that you couldn't see from the movie, but it is roughly true that cell mass, considered generically, more or less goes up exponentially with increasing cell size. And that's, you know, kind of to a first approximation, independent of how many nuclei you have in there, how many genome equivalents you have in there. So it seems like, provided that you're not too far off the kind of normal, you know, nuclear dosage per an amount of cytoplasm, that the cytoplasm just grows itself. You know, the ribosomes make more ribosomes and so forth. So the concept of a mass doubling time is almost a legitimate real exponential function. I mean, not quite, but within a pretty reasonable range. It's pretty surprising. You can make cells quite a bit bigger or quite a bit smaller than they normally are, and measure mass increase, and it's pretty much proportional to how much you've got. Right, and so then this is the entrainment of growth and division. The cell division cycle per se, which I'll define more precisely what I mean by that, can be accomplished in quite a short time, which is shorter than the mass doubling time even in the best possible medium. Okay, so you always have to do something to slow down, to not do too many cell cycles, so that the mass doubling, which is the ultimate driver, is entrained with the cell division. Okay, so that's coordination of growth and division. It works because, for some reason, smaller cells are less likely to initiate the cell division cycle. We don't really know how this works. The one clue that we've got is a particular gene called CLIN3, which I'm calling here an initiator cyclin, an initiator for the reason that it has this property of driving, you know, when cells start the cell cycle, and a cyclin, I'll tell you what that is in a bit. Anyway, the one clue that we've got about this, I think, about this coordination of growth and division is, at least one good clue, is that if you fool around with the gene dosage of this particular cyclin, CLIN3, you can modulate the set point for when cells will kick in and, you know, make a bud and make another cell. So that, and this is, you know, changing the gene dosage over kind of reasonable ranges. So, you know, one copy in a diploid, like half a dose, you know, cells will go into the next cell cycle a little bigger, two copies are going a little smaller, three copies a little smaller yet. So it's kind of in a reasonable range. It doesn't take 100 copies or something like that. The relationship is not linear. That is to say, you double the gene dosage, cells don't get half as big. It's much less than that, but anyway.
And how the cell knows how big it is?
No, there really is not, there's no compelling evidence for how that works. There's there's an idea, which is that if the, you know, so it seems like nuclear cytoplasmic ratio is an old idea, been around for a long time, and it seems like something like that almost has to be involved. How could you use, for example, something like CLIN3 to measure nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio? There's a nice, simple, and easily stated idea that if the bigger a cell is, the faster it can make CLIN3, number one, and if CLIN3 thus made then accumulates in the nucleus, then the nuclear volume doesn't change, right? Then you can just measure the nuclear concentration of CLIN3, and that will be a direct readout. Whether that is actually, it's a nice idea, and CLIN3 is in the nucleus, and that's nice, but whether that is actually how it works, I think we completely don't know. And I think it's actually unlikely to be that simple.
Why would you be able to make it faster than the
cell? Well, you have more ribosomes, and, you know, they're just sitting out in this sea of cytoplasm, and the sea just keeps on getting bigger. If the stuff can then, wherever it's made out there, find its way back to the nucleus, and if its RNA is never limiting, which is an assumption, you know, then the bigger cells will just make more.
So the number of ribosomes in a cell is proportional to its volume?
Pretty close, yes. Pretty close. But we don't really understand how that works. Okay, so this is the sort of the picture. You know, you with some intracellular stuff now illustrated here, chromosomes that get duplicated, you build this. So this is the cell division cycle per se, duplicating the chromosomes, building this mitotic spindle, tugging to either pole. Then you make two new cells. They separate, and as I mentioned, there's a big one and a little one. The little one takes a little longer to go into the next cell cycle. Okay, so How does the cell division cycle work? And so here, this is something that I think really counts as a really good idea. And this is the one thing really that I think you should remember from my talk. And this is a proposal that came pretty much simultaneously from Kim Naismith and Paul Nurse, based on a whole lot of experiments, mostly in budding and fish and yeast, but also many experiments in other systems as well. So the idea is you've got all these things that you want to do. You want to, you know, double the DNA, build the spindle, pull, and you know there are various things along the and then separate the cells. And there are various bad things that you could imagine happening if you have the ability to do these things that you don't want to happen. For example, you don't want to start re-replicating DNA before you've divided, you know, because that'll give you extra ploidy. If you have the ability to do cytokinesis, you don't want to do it here, right? Because that just gives you an empty shell. You want to do it here, and so forth. There's kind of issues of doing things at the right time that are not easy to solve generically. And this
time, you're really meaning the right sequence.
Time and sequence, both. Maybe mostly sequence. Yeah. Sequence is probably the critical thing. It happens in E. coli, and the reason presumably why they can get away with it is they make these onion skins, and you can work out that that's okay because they only have one origin on a circular chromosome, one origin and one chromosome, right? That's the really important thing. So no matter how many times you initiate there, as you unroll the whole thing, you'll end up with just everybody with one chromosome, provided you couple division to having a chromosome in the end. And this is, I think, why eukaryotic cell cycle control is totally different from prokaryotic cell cycle control. And I think it all derives from having lots of linear chromosomes, because it's clearly, experimentally can be shown to be very bad. Of course, it's terrible to be missing a chromosome, but it's pretty bad to have bad balances too. And so, you know, you can imagine if you've made five chromosomes, you make an extra copy of the sixth, that's not too good. You want to not do that. Okay, so here's the idea. The idea is if you have an oscillator, so something is going to go up and down in a robust fashion, and then what you do is you take your various bits of cell cycle machinery, you know, very complicated machinery, right? Horrendous, you know, dozens and dozens of proteins for each one. To make a bud and segregate it into a new cell and to make a spindle and all that stuff, and set it up as set each one of them up as two-step processes in such a way that one step is promoted by the high level of X and the other step is inhibited. And the nice thing about doing it this way is then that as you walk through the cycle of high and low X, you'll do the steps in alternation. And the other point is that it's easier if I show you some examples, but this is the idea. So here's a specific example for one of the point that was just made, actually control of replication. Here's how that works. So the thing that oscillates, of course, is cyclins, particularly B-type cyclins, and this is what Tim Hunt got the Nobel Prize for discovering, these guys that go up and down in the cell cycle, and this is why they go up and down, okay? At origins of DNA replication, they have basically three states. They have one state where they're loaded up with all kinds of origin binding proteins that have to be there in order for the thing to be able to fire. They then can be actually in the process of being fired where the helicases are starting to move down and replication is proceeding. And then they can be replicated but unloaded, right? So the way the cyclin machinery works is that if the high cyclin-dependent kinase activity is presented with a loaded origin, it will simultaneously fire it but also block reloading. So this is very economical, right? If you have low cyclin-dependent kinase activity, you'll load up all your origins and you won't use them. When the kinase activity comes back up, you'll fire them, but you won't reload them. And so that gives you ordering. This is a very complicated process how this works, and one little part of it actually is that these MCM proteins, which are the replicative, probably most likely the replicative helicases, the things that actually unwind DNA ahead of the replication fork, at least that's the best idea for what they are, these things are only present in the nucleus at the time when CDK activity is low. And actually I have, the movie that I showed you before that I had up when you came in was the phase image that corresponded to this GFP image. Now, so what we're seeing here is one of the MCM proteins, one of these components of replicative helicase tagged with GFP. And it's a little faint, but I think you can see this is those little spots that come and go are MCM protein in the nucleus. And if you look, watch this cell. There's no signal. It's all inside. And then right as they divide, you see it come back into the two nuclei. So you can actually visualize in this way the brief period when cyclin-dependent kinase activity is low. And that's when the origins can reload, but they don't fire. They fire when the kinase activity comes back up. Then all the MCM proteins get shipped out into the cytoplasm. You can't get replication because these things are essential for replication. And obviously they have to be in the nucleus to work. The other thing you can notice if you look closely at the movie is that you always see a little longer persistence of the nuclear MCM signal in the daughters than you do in the mothers. This is exactly the same thing. The daughters take longer to kick in. Yeah, Peter.
I couldn't understand what the physical process
They are required for DNA replication. What they do is part of the process of replication origin loading is sticking on an MCM. It's a little, most likely a ring, little ring. Stick on a little ring right at the origin, but it doesn't do anything. Somehow or other, when cyclin-dependent kinase activities come on, that ring will then start to translocate down the DNA, unwinding it as it goes. And that's at least the stuff that's there probably stays, but all the extra MCM proteins, which are present in quite a lot of excess, at the same time get shipped out of the nucleus so that they can't reload onto the origin again. This is one part of at least a three-part mechanism to keep replication from happening more than once. It's very redundant. Okay, does everyone see the things going in and out? Okay. Okay. So, spindles get made and elaborated, and it's the same thing. If you block the system with low cyclin-dependent kinase activity, you just have these little microtubule organizing centers, but no spindle. If you stop the system with high cyclin-dependent kinase activity, you stop right here with this long spindle, chromosomes all separated, but you do not break the spindle down. You don't do the resetting step. Is it of interest to see what the spindles look like? Is that worth it? Yeah. Okay. They're pretty.
You always like movies.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought. You know. I think.
Am I right? You might be one of them.
Yeah. This is one of our earlier movies, so the cinematic quality is not so high. But anyway, you can see. So there's a divided. So you see these two little dots, and then every once in a while, just for a brief time, you'll see this long thing. So that's kind of you're seeing there just the end stage.
What do you label there?
This is alpha tubulin, which remarkably enough, you can stick a GFP onto it and it'll still assemble into the filaments and just do its job with absolutely, it's for free. It's quite extraordinary that you can do it. All the alpha tubulin has GFP. Yeah, this is one of Andrew's things, I think, originally. Yeah, this GFP tagging thing is something that you get away with much more often than you think you ought to be able to. It generally, you know, you stick the thing at the carboxy terminus and the protein usually works just fine. I mean, at least 3 times out of 4. Typically, if you push it, you find out that it's not really 100%, but it the thing is compensated enough that it doesn't matter. Okay, so that's the spindle. It is pretty, isn't it? Okay. All right. Last one that I have here is the budding business. Now bud initiation is actually not really driven by this main mitotic cyclin. That's a kind of a special thing. It's driven by other cyclins, but it's kind of the same principle. And certainly, the final step of cytokinesis is strongly blocked by this same activity. Okay. So overall, this will then work pretty nicely to give you, if you hook it up so that when, you know, the cell gets big enough, it makes enough CLIN3, let's say, somehow that, and we have some understanding of how that high those high initiator cyclin levels can then kick in a pulse of B-type cyclin, then these things will happen in kind of the right order. And so there's still some issues of ordering and doing it right that are not solved here, but anyway.
The picture is as far as having a neck where the bud is coming off, that's more than just a cartoon, is it?
This is certainly no more than a cartoon, but what is your question?
Well, you've drawn the neck much smaller than the size of the...
Yeah, it's real small.
The bud. And
yeah. It's a small little thing. There's tons of structure there. I mean, there's all many, many filaments, and it's actually one of the kind of organizing centers of the cell along with the spindle pole bodies. There's just a lot of stuff there, a lot of regulation. It's obviously very important for the cell to have this done right. Okay, so.
What specifies that position?
There's machinery that does it that is specific and interesting, and it depends on the cell type, but on the other hand, if you totally disrupt and remove that machinery, the cell apparently picks a site at random and it doesn't matter. For anything that anyone's been able to find, this is an extraordinary thing. It must be for something, but, you know, to a person... Well, the reason that they don't make more than one bud, actually, is yet another example of this same principle that I didn't have on the slide, but I could have done. It's quite clear that the reason why other cyclins actually are involved in initiating the bud is that the main mitotic cyclin prevents bud initiation. So it's exactly the same idea. Once you get into here, you won't make another bud because you got too much of this stuff. You can get around that by artificially suppressing it, and then cells will very nicely rebud for you at some other place. So all these things are, you know, kind of based on experiments. Same principle. Okay, so things then get ugly, because what it turns out is that there's not just the one cyclin going up and down. There's this grotesque profusion of the things. And this is, to a limited extent, just gene duplication having a lot of copies of the thing, which sort of doesn't matter very much. That's easy to think about, but not entirely. It's very clear from a lot of experiments that we and other people have done that these guys have specialized quite a good deal in the course of evolution, such that some are much better at doing some things than others, and that ends up mattering quite a bit for how the final efficiency of the whole system.
Which ones of these are lethal?
None of them. No single. A few of the doubles are sort of semi-lethal, but if you want to really block the cell cycle, it generally takes triples to quadruples. It's bad. It's just, and you know, there's a complicated pattern of who does what. I mean, it does sort of make sense. One of the few lucky things in the whole business is that by sheer random chance, it turns out that these numbers actually ended up being adjacent numbers for kind of adjacent and related functions. That absolutely didn't have to be that way. And you can, I don't know what the odds are obviously against it, you know, but that's just the way. I mean, it would have been nicer if this was number one, for example, and that didn't work out. But, you know, these guys are the mitotic guys, basically, and they're one and two and so forth. So that was just lucky. No, it's just the order in which they were isolated. It's just... You call it a B-type cyclin, so it's a CLIB, and the first one that anyone found was number one, and so forth. You know, it's arbitrary, but on the other hand, it saves a lot of confusion. The mammalian guys, for example, everyone that discovers a gene calls it by a new name. So you see in these papers, you know, it takes two lines to write the name of the gene because you have to include everybody else's name, or else you make enemies. This has the advantage that there's one name. It might not mean anything, but at least it's the name. Anyway, but it is hard. I mean, it just adds to the kind of price of admission for understanding this stuff, that you have to kind of remember all these little names. Okay, so this brings up another point, which is this. So this is a Rube Goldberg machine, and the idea was, originally a joke, to build the most complicated machine possible to perform a simple task. And there's an example here of a guy that wants to fall on a pillow when he slips. And when you look at the way that cell cycle machinery actually works, it looks a lot more like this than like some, you know, elegant thing that you might want to design. And of course, part of the reason for that is historical. And you know, if you look at this picture and kind of imagine, you know, it started off with a guy walking a dog, and he never wanted to let go of the dog, and he kind of went on from there. Even at the end, the thing which is supposed to drop this pillow under him, it obviously isn't working very well. Plus, he couldn't actually stand up straight. But anyway, so the question is, you know, is this thing really just a Rube Goldberg machine, or are there some kind of deep principles that that can eventually be seen? So that's the challenge. This is the actual machine, sort of more or less, not with everything in there, but with most of it, and it is kind of, it's just awful, right? I mean, it's far from transparent, let's say. There are some of the things in, and there's a lot of other machinery that I didn't even put in here because at a certain point it's enough, really. So what I'd like to do in the remaining bit of time is to try to see how far we can get pulling out some general principles from this stuff. But in the end, we're not going to really know if these are general principles just because of the complexity. But anyway, there's some ideas.
Can I ask a technical question?
Sure.
With all these networks keeps talking about general principles.
Yes.
I've yet to hear them.
Okay, well.
Apart from oscillators, perhaps.
Yeah, well.
I mean, would be very helpful.
You mean like an example of what kind of a general principle?
Yeah, I've yet to hear one. In the months that I've been here, we've had interminable talks about networks and general principles.
Well, they do, of course, tend to be very particular.
Unless I've listened.
Right. I mean, they are very specific. You know, it's just like, yeah, yeah. So no, I think. Well, I don't know. I think by the time I get to the, you know, the conclusion about the oscillators, I think there are some kind of formal similarities. Yes. Well, this is another oscillatory system. Right. In the end. Right. And that may be the only reason why. I don't know that there's anything in general to be said. Yeah. Well, I hardly have any transcription factors in here, actually. That's one of the things that I left out. In fact, I don't have any. There are none of them in here. It's one. I was mentioning this yesterday. This is a weird fact. Of the genes in this system, let's see, all of these and this one, all of them but one, all of them but two, I guess, are transcriptionally regulated to varying degrees, some of them very, very tightly through the cell cycle. On the other hand, in every case where there is such transcriptional control, you can ablate it and make anywhere from a medium to, in some cases, stupendously high levels of overexpression, and the system still runs. Yeah. Oh yeah, I should say what all this means, right? Well, they're very generic, right? They just mean activation of one kind or another. Well, it just let's see. I mean, I can go through and tell you. This one and this one are proteolysis. This one is, I'll talk about actually, it's activation, and I'll talk a bit about the proteolysis. This is activation by phosphorylation. Proteolysis, phosphorylation leading to degradation, phosphorylation leading to inhibition, you know, and so forth, right? It's very generic. It's the only way to, you know, get anything that you can even look at, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
The positive feedback, you can actually see there's this little cluster in here of mutual inhibition, right? That works. And then there's a little negative feedback loop over here, and there's a complicated sort of, you know, this thing does that which activates that and activates that which inhibits those. It's bad, you know, really.
Is there anything systematic in notation here which indicates
no.
Kinases,
no, I'm afraid not. It's the same gene name business. Sorry about that. I have them sort of color-coded at least where the actually this one should, I don't actually, no, so I'll take that back. No, there really isn't anything. Sorry. It's just alphabet soup. Sorry.
So what is in the single assembly phase?
Once you've built a spindle, there is this further step of this PDS1 protein that keeps the spindle from elongating, it keeps the chromosomes from separating by an indirect mechanism. If you take that out, which you can delete this thing, just like almost everything else on this whole picture you can delete this thing, and then in fact it is pretty much true that you build a spindle and you go right to the long spindle. But there you really do stick because of this mechanism until you get rid of the B-type cyclins. Okay. All right, so let's see if we can simplify this thing at all. So the first thing is to yeah, yeah.
With regard to the question of generality, those things do look, in many cases, you look at any particular incident to the network like that, and it looks sort of designed ad hoc, right, with all sorts of components that are unique to it and all that. But in fact, if you look across signaling systems that are very widely in purpose in different sort of cell types, different organisms even, there are a lot of commonalities, though, right? I mean, conserved MAP kinase signaling unit, for example, is used over and over again in multiple instances.
Oh, yes. There's certainly little bits of machinery that get...
...complexes and gospel and used over and over
yes.
again with different kinetic properties, but the essence of the thing is repeated over and over again. So the idea that there might be something that is general in the behavior of those things is not unreasonable.
Well, certainly, I mean, the MAP kinase example is clearly just like the same very or similar bit of machinery that gets plugged in different places, the same kind of thing with small GTP binding proteins like RAS. What they'll get used for, what the inputs and outputs can just be varied in an arbitrary fashion. This machinery actually is used in a few other, some of the cyclin-dependent kinase site machinery does get used in a few other areas of biology other than cell cycle, but the bulk of it is for cell cycle control. So that particular thing of using the same machinery elsewhere, you don't so much see.
Can you remind us what anaphase and telophase
excuse me?
What anaphase and telophase correspond to?
So anaphase is complicated. There's more to it than one step. But basically, if you have the chromosomes have been replicated, you've built the spindle, but you have not yet separated them. That's called metaphase, basically. As you pull the chromosomes apart into two separate masses, that's anaphase. Telophase, as I'm considering it, is the final step when you then disassemble the final mitotic spindle and then reform the, in higher cells, reform the nuclei. You actually keep the nuclei the whole time. So it's mainly like spindle disassembly and reset. It's a resetting step. That last thing is the thing that's inhibited by the high kinase activity. Nothing else is. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a semantic question. It's clearly an independent process. You could get the one to go without the other, although the system, of course, really doesn't want that to happen. Right. Right. But it can. Okay. So what are the bits and pieces of the oscillator? And here we're on really pretty solid ground because these are biochemically, pretty well-defined biochemically and genetically well-defined things. So the way these cyclins, considered generically, the whole superfamily works, is by binding to a protein kinase and activating it. And there's a well-defined structural transition that happens to the kinase. Of course, you don't see it here because it's a cartoon, but it's crystallographically well-defined what happens. You rearrange this inactive kinase and turn it into something that will work. And by working, what that means is its job is to take ATP and stick phosphate onto some target. Okay. Now we then have this kind of vague concept that we have some target which is just a red triangle, and when it gets phosphorylated, things happen. Actually, it's embarrassing, but that's almost it doesn't go a whole lot farther than that for a lot of the important stuff. We don't really know very much about the targets of these kinases. We know the kinase is very important and it goes up and down and all that stuff, and we know what the events are. The mechanisms for how you put a phosphate onto something and then something, various things happen, replication or whatever it is, in many cases is poorly to not understood at all. But anyway, this is the canonical picture. For? You mean how it finds its targets? There are diverse mechanisms for that. And opinions differ as to how important those, to what extent, for example, it's like a, you know, a stable binding that latches the thing on so it can just put phosphate on but not come off, as opposed to transient things. We just don't know in general. I think the actual cases will vary all over the map. Yeah. Phosphatases are never as specific, I don't believe. There's certainly at least one highly regulated phosphatase that actually made it onto the Rube Goldberg machine slide, and there are doubtless other generic phosphatases that just work to keep the system damped down, but we don't know too much about them. Phosphatases are tough because they tend to, on the whole, be pretty general, and therefore the genetics is practically impossible. You knock one out and just, you know, all kinds of things don't work, and to disentangle which phosphate is the relevant one is really, really hard. So that's been slow. They're obviously very important, but hard.
So for,
yeah?
Since you can knock out one by one and still maintain viability, do you see specific sets of proteins that fail to be phosphorylated?
Well, that exact experiment, there it's hard to do that in a sort of a proteomic way. We've tried with Brian Chai to work out ways to do that, and so far not really been successful. There are a few cases of a few targets where you can really say it's these cyclins that hit that protein, because when we knock out these non-essential cyclins, that protein doesn't get phosphorylated. There are a few cases like that, but not too many. No, I would have to say no. I mean, not really. Not based on anything really very. The one thing that you can do, and this is something that a student in Brian Chai's lab has been looking at, it does turn out, although there's no obvious principled reason why this should have to be that way, but it does turn out that certainly the large majority of cyclin-dependent kind of substrates that we know about have not just one site of phosphorylation, but a bunch of them, you know, and they tend to be sort of clustered too. And since there is a weak recognition sequence, which is the phosphorylatable residue followed by a proline and then a basic residue a few farther along, you can actually look through the genome sequence and ask, you know, how many proteins are there that have a whole bunch of those types of sites? And is that statistically meaningful compared to just scrambling the sequence and seeing what you get? And it turns out that by the time you get to about 5 sites, which is a reasonable number, that's where the genome all of a sudden has a lot more hits than the scrambled the proteome has a lot more hits than the scrambled proteome. Doesn't mean that there aren't real phosphorylation targets with only one site. It says you can't detect them that way. If you do that and say, okay, I'm only going to really believe that the ones, you know, that emerge from the real proteome over the scrambled proteome are real, then you get a number something like 50 or so, probably still too high. I mean, we don't know. And the other, of course, very disappointing result that many, many people have had and very few people report. So this is a very general sad thing that happens, is that you take one of these proteins that has the 5 or 6 or whatever number of phosphorylation sites, and you think it's got to be good for something. So you mutate all those sites, you put the thing back in, and nothing happens at all. That's happened. I'm 0 for 8 or something personally. And you know, you ask people at meetings, and you know, no one will feel sorry for you because everybody's had the same experience. It's kind of an interesting problem because you can't report that stuff actually. Pretty much, you try. It's the rules of the biological literature. I mean, I see Jay over here nodding.
Maybe in that experiment you can't trust the negative result?
It's not that it's a wrong result. It's just, I don't know, I've been trying to work this out, and it is something that I find, the reason I mentioned it actually, in a biological audience I wouldn't even bother mentioning it, but physicists tend to be surprised by this fact, and I can see why when I think about it. I can't really justify it, but it's just a fact. I mean, you know, right, the biologists will agree with me. You know, the fact that you mutate a bunch of phosphorylation sites and nothing happens, if people reported that, the literature would be 10 times as big and 1/10 as informative as it even is now.
All the time.
What's that?
It happens all the time.
Yes, it happens all the time. And it's many other things, too.
Okay.
That maybe.
No, no, it's like a lot of short, useful papers.
Yeah.
Just a
general
yes.
So you might have an electronic repository.
I have a repository.
Right?
Yes.
But you may not be making a database or not a things that never did anything.
Yeah, the trouble with that is.
You've got to be very careful here. I don't think there are yeasts. But with mice, if you knock out a gene and you don't have a phenotype, it means nothing. You've got to take the mice to the opera and see if they can still distinguish gamma from beta. So when you say there's no effect, you've got to put the yeast in the right condition. Maybe you have to put them at pH 3.2.
Yes, no, of course, I mean, yeah, well, oh yes, you do have to, I shouldn't say that there is no effect. It's an operational statement, meaning that over the range of things that I thought this thing might have had something to do with, it doesn't do anything that I can detect.
Right. That's, I don't believe in redundancy.
Yeah, well, I think that's a, I don't know what I think about redundancy. I think it's pretty hard to avoid the impression that it's there, but anyway. Okay, yeah, yeah, Mike.
I just have one quick question.
Yeah.
Does each of the cyclins have a dedicated cyclin-dependent kinase?
No, all these guys that I'm talking about have one cyclin-dependent kinase in yeast. That's not so in mammalian cells and flies as well. What's that? They all share the same kinase in the yeast system. In the animal case, it's more diverged. Yeah. Okay, so this is the other main piece of the oscillator. So we've got the thing that makes the cyclin, and that makes the kinase, which actually does stuff, right? How do you get rid of the cyclin? Which is, again, the other half of Tim Hunt's discovery. You know, the thing goes up and then it comes down. Why does it come down? This is a big protein complex, the anaphase promoting complex, like 12 or so subunits. Totally conserved throughout eukaryotes. Bacteria don't have it at all. And what it does is to put ubiquitin chains onto the target. There's a short 76 amino acid protein, goes on in multiple chains. And once those things are on there, then this thing gets recognized by a proteolytic machinery and chewed up and killed. Now there's more to it than that, because you need, in order to get the target efficiently to the APC, you need these adapter proteins. So this is very common. You know, that to facilitate molecular interactions, you have a bridging protein, and in this case, this is true as well. But things get kind of interesting here, actually, from the point of view of the system, because there are two flavors of adapter. They're clearly homologous proteins. I mean, if you run one through the database, you'll get, you know, if you run CDC20, you'll first get a bunch of things that look a lot like CDC20, then you'll get all the CDH1s. And then that'll be just about every eukaryote, you'll get both. And clearly, the one will be different from the other. The way that they work is they have one surface, most likely, that binds the APC, another surface that binds specific targeting sequences in the target proteins, and that's called the destruction box, or a DB. Okay, so and it's called that because if you have it, the thing gets destroyed, and if you don't, it doesn't. Okay, so what is interesting about this is that is the nature of their activity and how it's regulated. So the CDC20 flavor of adapter protein basically does not work very well. For example, in an in vitro experiment, it's hard to get it to drive much ubiquitination. What makes it work better is to phosphorylate the APC, and phosphorylated APC then works very well with CDC20. And the curious and interesting part is that the main, or in budding yeast, possibly the only enzyme that puts the relevant phosphate onto the APC is the cyclin-dependent kinase itself. Okay, so this thing is activating the thing that will eventually destroy it. Right? CDH1, on the other hand, is exactly the opposite. CDH1 by itself, in its sort of normal situation, works extremely well. It's a voracious and, you know, very effective activity at destroying things, but if it gets phosphorylated, once again, by the same cyclin-dependent kinase, then it doesn't work at all. The mechanism is a little different now. It just doesn't bind to the APC. But the net effect is the same. Okay, so you've got these two family members. They're doing the same job of bringing the destruction box protein containing targets to the APC, but they're regulated in exactly opposite sense by the target itself. Okay, so it clearly gives you kind of a dynamic feel to the thing. Okay, so this is just to remind you, the aim here is to alternate high cyclin and kind of low APC, otherwise it gets degraded, with the opposite, high APC and low cyclin, and that allows you to alternate replication and segregation of genetic material because of the two-step mechanism that I went through earlier. And then we have these kind of interesting rules about the critical adaptor proteins that bring the cyclins to the APC, where one gets positively regulated by the target, the other negatively. How do you put it all together and make an oscillator? And of course, we don't really know. But if you look at the machinery in yeast and also in kind of eukaryotic cells in general, you can make a sort of a generalization. And this is I would say, more of an analogy than a formal statement, because we don't really know that these things are formally relaxation oscillators or negative feedback oscillators, but they sort of look like that. And you can see how that would work in the case where the cyclin activates the APC, which is the CDC20 case. That looks sort of like a negative feedback loop. There's clearly going to be a lot more to it than just this, but you can abbreviate it like this. The other system is the one where there are the two alternative states, right? One where the cyclins are high, keeping the inhibitors, and not only the CDH1, but another guy, SYK1, that is this I haven't talked about. It's a stoichiometric inhibitor that sort of works together with CDH1. And so it also is inhibited by the cyclins. It gets degraded when it's phosphorylated. And then an alternative state, this the reverse, and then you need these little toggling things to switch back and forth between them. Now, for various reasons, it's been the case that this form of the oscillator has been what's most obvious and what's really been proposed based on looking at the embryonic cell cycle. This is what you see. The embryonic cell cycle, well, for one compelling reason, there isn't even any CDH1 around, and none of the inhibitors to speak of either. So this is really all they've got to go on. Working on the yeast system, especially the budding yeast system, this has been what people have seen, and this guy has been sort of ignored. On the other hand, it's clear that the machinery for both of these things is present in the budding yeast system.
That so-called negative feedback oscillator, does it involve transcription at all, or can it?
One of the complications to calling it a negative feedback oscillator, among others, is that in fact there is the potential, at least, for a positive feedback loop for transcription on the B-type cyclin itself. It does, in some sense, promote its own expression. So it's very unlikely, even if this is a real thing, that it's a pure negative feedback oscillator. And there's an argument in the embryonic case that was recently made by Jim Farrell that this thing is, although it has this shape, that there's, excuse me? Oh, just the two-component thing. Yeah, there's other stuff. I think there is another component in here that I just haven't drawn. I mean, there's the APC. Right, which it has to get phosphorylated. So there's definitely at least three components. And, you know, these things are all being defined in living cells with this transcription, and there's a lot of other components.
But I think even in principle, you need a third component.
In principle, you need a third component, yes. So that's certainly...
Three, four feet salting back.
Yeah, any attempt that I've made to model something like this absolutely, of course, doesn't work with two components. And I think that's, as far as I understand, known in principle to be true. You got to have a third. Right, I'm sure that's true. I'm just simplifying... as much as possible, just to make the contrast.
That's a general principle that you need a third component.
That's just a rule, yeah.
Positive feedback is self-feedback.
Yeah.
There's error on the...
Which one? Either the CDC feeding back on itself.
Right.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, or some other thing that's an intermediary. Yeah.
I just want to point out that you can have a chemical oscillator based on two components, but what you need is
Yes.
There are many examples of
right.
Two components of
right.
The chemical system.
Right. So it's not right.
Can work if you put a positive.
Right. It's not literally that you need a third component, but you need a third arrow. Let's say.
Yeah.
Is that okay? So that's the correct statement then. Yeah. Right. So that in fact could be sufficient. Okay. So this is not too bad. But I think these things really are at the present level analogies and not formal statements. That's clear, I think, okay. but still it's useful to think about. And what brings it out for me in particular is these two family members doing the same biochemical job and regulated in an opposite sense. And this is just a way to sort them out, kind of. Okay, so this is...
We have these questions of how sinusoidal and non-sinusoidal are various things, which
yes.
can help now and maybe practice.
I don't think we have measurements that would be good enough to say. The one thing, certainly... The final, no, I don't think we know. It's hard, there are technical reasons why it's difficult to really answer that question properly. What the real shape of the thing is, I don't think we know.
But it'd be something which, I mean, you know, longer term future, if there are ways to develop it.
Can you make it into a phosphorylation of some targets, right? Over the cell cycle, that they look more clumpy than sinusoidal?
I just don't think we have data of that level of resolution to know. Just don't know. You can do those things, but in order to get the problem, the reason is fundamentally that in order to get the synchrony remotely good enough to look in such a way that you can believe it, you have to do something so forceful that you've seriously distorted the system. It's going to be very different from the free-running system.
Or you need to do single cells.
Yeah, or you need to do it with single cells, and then you, I mean, I think this is one of the things we really, it does seem like, you know, things like this MCM2 going in and out of the nucleus is in principle a visualizable single cell readout for, roughly speaking, when the kinase activity comes and goes. And to the extent we can expand those things and use them. And I think the real payoff is to incorporate that together with mutants and looking at what happens then at a single cell level. But we're not there yet. Yeah. Oh, CDC is Lee Hartwell's thing. It stands for cell division cycle. And what anything that says CDC on it basically was discovered by Lee Hartwell as something that went as a temperature sensitive thing, that when you raise the temperature, the cells would all look about the same. Nothing whatsoever. Although it did in the end turn out to be a pretty good idea, right? But yeah, it doesn't tell you anything. There's no informative thing.
CDK is cycle independent kinase.
CDH is, it means CDC20 homolog. Sorry, doesn't help much. It's just what it is. You know, you could number them just 1 through 6,000, and it would be almost as good. Anyway, we have the little names, and you know, what's really worse. It makes it even worse is that fission yeast also has a bunch of CDC names and other things like that, and all the numbers are different. That makes it really hard. So there's a CDC14 in budding yeast that does something totally different, and so forth. There's a CDC20 that does some other thing. That just is too much then, actually. It's really difficult even for... okay, I have time maybe to show you one experiment. Huh?
Oh, sure.
Yeah? I'll go on until people are, you know, whatever. But so...
Not forever, but... No,
that I can't do. No, actually. Okay, well, so... A little simpler version of the full circuitry than what I showed in the earlier slide, but it's just laid out so that you can see kind of this, you know, negative feedback oscillator and the other more relaxation oscillator enclosed in the two boxes. And the point about the slide is that right in the middle, at least as it's drawn, is this one cyclin, CLIB2, which is based on a lot of evidence, clearly not the only mitotic cyclin, because as I say, there's many of them, but it's the main one. It's the most kind of obviously significant one. And it demonstrably does have the effect in many different assays of promoting mitotic entry and inhibiting mitotic exit, the kind of two-step business what I was talking about. So a simple experiment then, given that we know that both CDH1 and CDC20, the kind of heart of this mechanism for dragging the thing down, require this same targeting sequence. You could ask, well, if this guy is really at the center of the circuitry, what happens if we just take its destruction box out? Don't do anything else, right, to the whole system, but just keep this thing from being recognized by either of these adapters, what will happen? So it turns out the first thing that happens is that you can't degrade this stuff anymore. That's good. So these are cells. You start cells off in the middle of the cell cycle and then send them into a block so that they will divide and arrest with low cyclin. This is kind of like, you know, it works. They go along for a while, and then the stuff all goes away. And this one, the destruction box mutant, you can't degrade at all. And the consequence of that is that the cells arrest in mitosis very cleanly. And so in this case, the tubulin, the microtubule, is stained with an antibody, which is the red, and the DNA is stained with the blue. And so this is, if you remember the movie with the microtubules, you know, there would be this transient stage, you have this long line, and then it would disappear right away. Well, that's where they go in this case, and that's where they stay. Okay, they've separated the chromatin, they have this long spindle, they can't do cytokinesis, they can't disassemble the spindle, they don't re-replicate DNA because they can't get rid of the cyclin. I think this is probably the simplest manipulation that's known that really blocks the cell cycle, because all the proteins in the cell are still doing all their normal jobs, right? The cyclin is still doing its thing. The anaphase promoting complex can degrade everything else. It just can't get to this one, and that's enough to block the thing. Okay, so the way I mentioned the way that this, at least part of the way that this works, and here we now have got another component in here explicitly, is by phosphorylation of the APC, which clearly makes CDC20 work much better than it did before. And so there's a tool to look at that, which was developed in Andrew Murray's lab. He identified by long and hard work most or all of the sites of phosphorylation in the APC, which is a bunch of them. I forget the number, like 12 or something like that. And this is actually an unusual case. I mentioned that usually you mutate phosphorylation sites and nothing happens. This is a case where it actually makes a difference. And you show that you could mutate all these sites, and then what would happen would be, well, what doesn't happen is that the system blocks. System still runs. It's kind of just sort of, it's not quite as good as it was before, but it's still a functioning system. But if you look at this picture, you can say, well, maybe this works because you still have this other business here to regulate. I mean, the idea is from the CLIP2 destruction box mutant, you got to get rid of this stuff somehow. And if this isn't working, maybe this is coming in and taking up the slack. And I should say that you can remove this gene as well, and the cell cycle still runs. So, yeah.
CLP2.
Yeah. How is it produced? Well, it's indicated here as if it was just transcribed and translated in a constitutive fashion, and that will work. In actual fact, it is under an additional transcriptional control. And so most of the experiments, that's the way it is. As an experimental fact, you can make it constitutive, and at least in the wild type case, it doesn't matter. We did this experiment of taking this unphosphorylatable APC case, which putatively will disable this thing, removing CDH1 altogether by gene deletion. Neither single thing causes any very significant problems. And the combination is completely unable to complete mitosis. It's pretty much like the destruction box mutant. So this, it seems like this is a sufficient picture. And you know, then they're dead, and you can rescue them with things. It's not worth going through. So this is one way to put together this overall set of results. The idea is that this is clearly real. This sort of relaxation oscillator type stuff with the ability of the high cyclins to suppress their negative regulators and the reverse. But the alternative steady state. The alternative state might not really be very stable. It might actually have this other little cycling thing embedded within it. Yeah.
I get confused about just the role of transcription translation in this.
So the role of transcription. Yes.
And proteolysis, basically, the stuff has to be replenished. But the statement is that transcription doesn't have to be modulated in cell.
In wild type cells, transcription does not have to be modulated whatsoever, of any individual thing or even of probably combinations of things. Although no one has ever been able to make everything in the cell cycle transcriptionally deregulated, that might well be bad. I don't know.
Has anyone tried?
to do everything all at once? No, I don't think so. There are tricks whereby you can deregulate sort of vast swatches of things all at once by screwing around with some transcription factors and making them constitutive, and you get away with that too. It's really pretty hard to break the thing, you know. That's why I was kind of proud of the CLIV2 destruction box mutant, because it's pretty simple and it does break it pretty well. Anyway, so this is sort of the idea that
Can that one be broken in a modulated way, so it's, you know, sometimes they'll work, sometimes they don't, instead of breaking completely the destruction box? And mutate forms that partially function and...
I don't know what would happen if you did that. You know, I mean, I guess depending on how you think the thing works, one possibility is that you might end up in a kind of a you know, some cells blocking and other cells going ahead, or I don't know what would happen.
Waiting a long time and then
going. Yeah, there are some other complexities to the targeting of these things to the APC. There are other sequences involved and so forth. So we haven't tried that. We just deleted the thing altogether.
Speaking of what are the numbers that are involved in this? How many?
The numbers of proteins. So we haven't quantitated everything, but the cyclins are in the vicinity of thousands per cell, thousands of protein molecules per cell. Pretty much all of them. A few of them are low, but sort of bulk. If you add all the cyclins together, it's going to be, you know, maybe, you know, 5 or 10,000 molecules per cell, so an approximation. The one place where it's interesting, though, there is one place where stochastic stuff seems very likely to come into play, and that's RNA. There's a remarkable website from Rick Young's lab where they actually purport to tell you on this website the average number of messenger RNAs per cell for every RNA in yeast. And the remarkable thing is that the canonical kind of usual number is something around 1, which is really a small number. You know, and you know, for something that's some stable protein that, you know, you make it and you save it for a while, you know, for many cell cycles, it probably doesn't matter too much. 1 is fine. But for something that you're degrading at every cell cycle, you know, if the average cell has 1 transcript, that's not, you know, that sounds really bad. I don't know if it's how literally to take that, but anyway, you can see it on the website. That's what. All the cyclins are all right around 1, every one of them.
Precisely, that it's so unstable actually helps, because you're time average.
Well,
so
yeah.
You can destroy many, many times over...
Except that that's not true, because you know the lifetime, and the lifetime is long enough, actually, that it looks like there have to be holes when you don't have any. It sounds perilous, but I mean, if it's 3 instead of 1, the issue probably disappears. I don't know if the quantitation's that good. Anyway, okay. So this is kind of the idea that there are these two mechanisms, and actually, genetically, you can pretty much get rid of all the components of this one, and cells will run on this one, and there are ways to do the reverse too. So it really does seem like there are two that work. I did want to mention a collaboration that I have going with John Tyson's lab. The idea is to model this system, and the philosophy here is it's all chemical kinetics ODE type modeling. The philosophy here is a little different from what we've seen. In fact, a number of people have said specifically that they don't want to do it like this, but anyway, this is what we're doing. The idea is to try to be realistic and to just pretty much put in what we know about. And the advantage of that is that it makes the translation between the model and the type of experiments that we do very easy. You don't have to say, like, if this one thing stands in for 20 different processes, how am I going to model some mutant? You just make the mutant in the computer and ask what happens. The other, and so it's realistic in that sense, in the sense we're trying to put not everything in, but a reasonable amount of stuff in with not too many simplifications. It's realistic in that the question is brought up about number of molecules. Of course, it's a deterministic continuous model, so there's no stochastic stuff in here, but the relative amounts of things are more or less tuned to experiments as best we can. And for some things that matters, because there are some stoichiometric effects in here that where it makes a difference if you have 10 times more or less of something. And the final way in which it's realistic, and the real way the model was made and tuned mainly by Kathy Chen, which is a lot of work to do, is the main constraint is mutants. Okay, so if you delete something, you know, what, and I think although there's some effort to be quantitative about it, the main thing is like, you know, mutations that kill the system versus mutations that don't, you know, and multiple mutations that do and don't. And so an example of that is, you know, this is like what happens if you model removing the destruction box from CLIB2, you know, you get mitotic arrest. And this is the more subtle thing of making unphosphorylatable APC, removing CDH1 or doing both, and you have to do both to get mitotic arrest. No, but they actually can get remarkably big. I mean, it's extraordinary how big a yeast cell can get before it eventually they lyse, but they can get easily 10 times normal size, quite fairly rapidly. That's part of the evidence, in fact, for this idea of a mass doubling time, is that when you do these types of things, you block the cell cycle, you're not making any more DNA. If there really is a mass doubling time over a certain range, you'd expect things to really get big pretty quickly. And to a first approximation, they do. Yeah. Well, I'm almost done, but you know, I'm happy to take a question.
How do you get all the kinetic constants for
such a? Oh yeah, so the kinetic constants. So you know, this is obviously the. I mean, I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that is obviously the glaring weak point in the whole thing. The shape of the equations, you can pretty much figure out this what it's going to be. There is the well stirred reactor assumption, which is clearly wrong. Right, obviously, you know, as was pointed out earlier, and even nucleus versus cytoplasm is not very explicit in here. But the kinetic constants are the worst part. Some of them you can get from data, you know, because you can actually say how fast do proteins go away from published data. Others, you just kind of have to constrain it by the mutants and hope for the best.
And how do you couple the set size or
mass? Oh yeah, right. So yes, so the way that's done is precisely by the theoretical idea that I mentioned at the beginning. This idea that big cells will make stuff faster, it'll all concentrate and, you know.
But you just said there's only one RNA on the average for various things. Is that going well with that idea?
I think there's lots of problems with that idea. I mean, I think that this business about the growth and division and how you drive it, even without the stochastic stuff, I think is a weakness here, because we don't really know that that model is correct, and the stochastic thing only makes it worse. Okay, that's all I can.
It would be useful to know, for example, whether the selectivity of the cell cycle comes mostly from checkpoints, for example.
Yeah.
And life would be not similar to.
Right.
You model it only a piece rather than the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because other things seem like last cycle events, like, you know, it'd be great if they go into something to the other.
Right.
Right. So that would be an interesting question.
I think we don't really know even how variable it really is. If you look at the movies in detail, you can see that for sure, you know, although there are these kind of general rules, like the daughters are slower than the mothers, if you actually look at the numbers, how much slower they are, and there's tremendous variability. There's a lot of variability in there.
And how many components are being modeled here?
How many things are changing? I don't remember exactly, but in the vicinity of a dozen or so, something like that, and maybe, you know, 40 or 50 or so parameters, adjustable parameters, yeah.
Looks like you have the right corner, your prediction is an increase in the cell lifetime of about 10-20%. Is that hold up?
Okay, so that's, again, gets back to the growth and division stuff. You have to decide whether you follow the mothers or the daughters, and what's being followed here is the daughters. And therefore, the what you're really following is how long a daughter takes to go through its next cell cycle, which will mainly be a function of how little it was when it was born. Since the mass doubling time is never changed here, there's only two possible answers. Either the predicted overall cell cycle, cell doubling time is going to either be that, or else you're going to fail and get some kind of arrest. The ultimate driver is mass doubling. And you either succeed in coupling that to the cell cycle, or you don't.
This cell size control, you've already explained it, and I missed it, acts as a checkpoint in the sense that the cell, not arrests, but stays in one of those.
Doesn't move forward until it's big enough.
Or is it rescaling, sort of stretching or compressing the oscillation?
It's the former. Yeah.
How does temperature influence?
Absolutely. In experiments, you're talking?
Experiments and comparisons.
Yes, I was asked about that yesterday, and I don't really know the answer. To a first approximation, everything is, the whole mass doubling time is changed when you change temperature to a significant extent. To a first approximation, I think everything in the cell cycle just scales to that. If you look at it as a snapshot of how many cells are there doing whatever at different temperatures, that number, that overall picture doesn't change much at different temperatures, even where the mass doubling time can be varying over wide ranges. That's probably not literally true, and I'm not sure how carefully it's been looked at. It's interesting, but I don't think there's any data. Okay, I just wanted to talk quickly about this. This is important, I think, in terms of thinking about this type of model. So this is one version of a robustness test that I did. Not quite with the model that I've been showing you, but I think they all are going to come out about like this. What I did was took the 40 or so parameters and just asked how many factors of two you could change them by before the thing died, where dying means no longer giving, a periodic solution. And the wild type is in black here, and it's pretty good. So there, the majority of the parameters actually you can either lower or even raise by over 100-fold, and some of them both actually. You can just, it would be like, why do you even bother having that parameter if it can be, 200 times higher or zero, than it is. It's pretty tough. There are a few that matter more, some that matter rather a lot. The ones that matter a lot are not, I must say, things that make a lot of sense, by and large. They're just things that turns out that they matter a lot, and we don't, I think that's just a weakness. But there aren't too many of them, anyway. I did it. Excuse me? I did this. It's all numerical, yeah. I mean, it's done automatically. I didn't actually have to sit at the computer and do it, but that's all it is. Yes, it's just a lot of numerical experiments, and there's I just set it up with a criterion so that if when the cell divided, in quotes, right? If when the cell divided, its entire set of everything that was being measured was the same or very similar to a previous time it divided, I'd say that's success. It's going to keep on doing that. No, I did not do that. That's important. This is only one dimension at a time. One at a time. Yes. I should be clear what I've done here. This is just statistical. So, if you couldn't change any parameter, it's a cumulative plot, right? Then they'd all be down here. If you could change them all to anything, they'd all be up here. It's a cumulative plot, yeah.
Suddenly I realized the similarity with Chris's thing yesterday, that there is one variable that exponentially grows and suddenly drops by some factor.
Yes.
Right? If this is there all the time, if you don't screw it up, right, then wouldn't that drive an oscillation any time? Or how do you stop the oscillation? Or something in the rule changes? If the mass is growing exponentially, that's the rule of the game.
Yeah, that's the rule of the game, right?
You hit a certain threshold, then you drop.
How you get to drop? Whether it drops or not.
It's whether it drops or not. That's right. Because what happens?
Like
here. That is really the whole game is in the boundary conditions. The rest of it is kind of the rule for the drop here. It's pretty reasonable actually. For this one, I know exactly what it is because I did this myself. So the rule here is, it's just based on all those rules that I told you about that, you know, you have to have an alternation in cyclin-dependent kinase activity to first initiate but not re-replicate, and you have to have low cyclin-dependent kinase activity to divide and disassemble the spindle and all that stuff. All those things have to, so the rules...
Initiation has one controlling it, that the clip would be degraded, or
It's all governed by getting clip kinase low enough. But the further constraint in this analysis is that the cell has to have been said to have budded, to have replicated DNA, to have made a spindle, and to have disassembled it, and all those things are required, which is kind of correct. Otherwise, the cell can't divide.
The size control at the moment has a minimal size checkpoint. So if it isn't big enough, it's not going to divide.
Yeah.
Right. How about the opposite? Suppose it is growing very, very fast. Is it going to oscillate, speed up the oscillator?
One of these sensitive ones that actually does make some sense is exactly the mass doubling time. That's a relatively sensitive one. Within a certain range, you speed things up and everything just goes faster and faster, but when the cell starts growing too fast, it gets into trouble.
If it goes too slowly, it's fine.
It can go very, very slowly and it's still fine. It's not a very realistic mass doubling time thing because it's just the denominator sort of, you know, it's not in most cases explicit that as you slow down the mass doubling time, you ought to slow down cyclin synthesis as well. There's a lot of things. The growth rate business is not very well handled in here. Kind of artificial.
But model aside, in reality?
Yeah, reality is always good.
I assume there is some way of speeding up the growth.
Well, only within kind of... slowing down is easy, but speeding up, it's like, you know, you've been growing them for some time, and if there were easy ways for them to grow faster, they probably would have found it already. Not to say that it's really optimized, but it you put them in the best medium you've got, and there's a certain time that things take. That time is, in fact, a little bit, not by much, but a little bit longer than the cell division cycle time. It's a little bit like the discussion we were having the other day about the intrinsic period and the length of the day. Is it good to have it a little bit off? At least so far, get the cells to double their mass any faster than they can do the minimal, make DNA and segregate stuff.
That's different between yeast and the fly, because in the fly, with insulin pathway, you can make them grow bigger without slowing down the clock.
Yeah, the whole business about coordination, growth, and division is clearly all the kind of governing rules clearly change when you get into an animal, and I think that's still a matter of debate. How much at bottom is going to be the same story or not? I don't think we know. No, but you know, I mean, one amusing exercise. Occasionally you meet a yeast guy that brews his own beer, you know, and like what they will do typically is they'll streak them out on a plate. And this guy Steve Haas told me, he says, you know, you streak out your brewing yeast on the same plate as the lab yeast, and it's like, you know, David and Goliath. It's like this enormous thing. The brewing yeast are so much faster growing. So there clearly is room for basically the same organism to grow a whole lot faster than these guys do. These guys have been just heavily tamed and domesticated. And anyway.
The Xenopus experiments on the tetraploids and the octoploids and so on, have some similar features of the cells being bigger, but somehow roughly at least the ratio of the cell size to the...
Well, yeah, if you double the... If you change ploidy, things seem to scale. Roughly, remarkably effectively, you know, you double the ploidy and everything sort of doubles.
But all we said is that cells in the multicellular organism are not necessarily optimized for
They're not optimized for fast growth, and the other
do something horrible to them,
right,
and make them grow faster, which is bad for the organism.
Right. The other critical difference is that free living organisms, the main thing is, you know, is there food around to eat to make another cell? Cells in the body typically are going to have been provided food, but they're not supposed to grow except under special circumstances. Okay, Wes, the only other point here is it's obvious that the mutants are very much more fragile. Okay, and that's sort of like, you know, the good news and the bad news. On the one hand, qualitatively, that's as it should be. It makes sense that the mutants will be more fragile. On the other hand, they're really a lot more fragile. You see all these things, all these parameters you basically can't change at all. From one point of view, those are sort of predictions. And actually, some of them are even sort of true in the sense that if you look at these things, you pick out things that are predicted to be more sensitive than others, and some of those actually are more sensitive. On the other hand, it's clearly not the case that there are all these things you can't even change by 1.3-fold. That's just crazy. So it's too sensitive. Yeah?
Does the model predict mutant effects that weren't used to constrain the model?
So this is the other thing about the whole approach, is we tend to use the information that we've got at any given time, but so it's not a rigorous formal process of the sort that you're sort of thinking of, which I think is regrettable, but kind of is where we are at the moment. On the other hand, just informally, it's a very useful tool where some things you can find things that are interesting that you didn't know about. And another thing that's kind of it's enough of a set of constraints that, for example, we had an experience where we felt compelled on the basis of a paper in the literature to include a new component in the sort of relaxation oscillator side of things. A paper was published saying that some other gene had quite an important role in that whole process, and it wasn't in the model, so we thought, oh, that's really bad, we got to put it in. Kathy Chen did. I mean, it was a lot of work, you know, because it was a whole new thing to put in, and she just couldn't get it to go. You know, she could get it to sort of work, but it was really fragile, and then all other things that had worked fine stopped working. And then we went back and actually rechecked the original observation about this other protein. Turned out to be completely wrong. Not a little bit wrong, just like, I don't know what these guys are doing. But, you know, it wasn't true at all. So that's kind of good in a way, you know. I mean, it is not empirically the case that you can get anything to go. That's all I can say. So.
From your model that you get a ton of predictions that have not been ever checked.
Oh, yeah, every one of these dots just about is a prediction that hasn't been checked, right. You test some of them are straightforward to test genetically, and some are not. The parameters, for example, can control specific activities of some protein. You don't know how to say you make the activity of this to resist exactly three times what it was. You know, things that come out that are like deletions of things, those are easy to test.
I think we should.
Yeah, I'm done anytime.
Well,
yeah.
I think we should thank you.
Good. Thank you.